CMDA Matters is made possible by members like us. I'm Amy Givler, a family physician from Monroe, Louisiana, and I've been a member of CMDA since 1980. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Well, it's February, and I want to welcome you back to another edition of CMDA Matters. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp, and I think we had a great start in January with guests like Dr. James Dobson, Dr. Christopher Ewan, who, by the way, will be one of our plenary speakers at the upcoming CMDA National Convention in Cincinnati, April 16th through 19th. We had Dr. Andre Van Maal, who talked about the transgender tsunami. And we also had Dr. Gene Wright on healthcare innovation, and a young med student, Mr. Zach Mead, who told us about a brand new medical school where both engineering and medicine are integrated in one program. Well, it is a new month, and today my guest is Dr. Fazale, who prefers the name Fuzz Rana. Dr. Rana from the organization Reasons to Believe. And he co-authored the new book, Humans 2.0, with Ken Samples. I found this book to be very insightful, and I believe you will as well. Fuzz says that the desire for human thriving through advances in technology, under the banner of transhumanism, bears an unexpected relationship to the Christian gospel. But before we get to that interview, I want to ask you to pray for us here at CMDA. It is a very busy time of the year, especially in terms of public policy. Just a few days ago, tens of thousands marched for life in Washington, D.C., and our very own Vice President for Government Relations, Mr. Jonathan Imbody, was right there on the podium with all the speakers and leaders. That event aims to build a culture of life in America, and CMDA is proud to be involved. One example of how we are building a culture of life, recently we filed an amicus or friend of the court brief on a case that's going before the U.S. Supreme Court right now involving an abortion clinic regulation. The case is known as June Medical Center versus Louisiana Gee, with Gee representing the Attorney General in the state of Louisiana. We have the American Center for Law and Justice that's representing us and helping us with that brief. This case deals specifically with a Louisiana law requiring physicians that perform abortions to have active admitting privileges at a local hospital. You know, to most of us, that seems an obvious and reasonable safety requirement for women who are undergoing that procedure, even as an outpatient. But the abortion industry views this health and safety regulation as a threat to their business. Our brief represents sound medical research and evidence that contradicts the abortion industry's mantra that somehow abortion is actually safer than childbirth. We respectfully disagree. You can read our brief that we've submitted at cmda.org/abortionbrief. That's cmda.org/abortionbrief. Please join me in praying for victory in this very important case, and we are most grateful for your prayers always. Let's get to the interview with Dr. Rana on his book, Humans 2.0. Dr. Rana attended West Virginia State College and then on to Ohio University, where he earned a PhD in chemistry. He was a presidential scholar and won the Donald Clippinger Research Award twice at Ohio University. Dr. Rana worked for 7 years as a senior scientist in product development at Procter & Gamble before joining Reasons to Believe, and you'll hear him refer to it as RTB. He's published many articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals. He's delivered presentations at many international scientific meetings and addressed church and university audiences in the United States and around the world. He's author of a number of books, which I mentioned during the interview, especially on the focus of the origin of life. Well, let's get right to the interview with Dr. Fuzz Rana on his book, Humans 2.0. Well, welcome, Dr. Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe. You're the vice president of that organization started by, I believe, by Hugh Ross, was it not?
Hugh Ross was the founder of the organization, and we've been in existence probably 33, 34 years now.
And you took the position of vice president about 7 years ago or so?
Oh, actually, I've been with RTB 20 years and have been a vice president for almost that duration. So I've been around for a lot longer than I'd like to admit now.
So I can see why you've written a number of books while serving at Reasons to Believe. Who Was Adam? Creating Life in the Lab, The Cell's Design, and Dinosaur Blood and the Age of the Earth. So this book that we're going to discuss today certainly is not your first rodeo.
No, it's not. And in some respects, it's something very different than I've ever written about. I typically have focused on origin of life issues and issues relating to the origin of humanity. But this is, in some respects, a logical extension of the book Who Was Adam, which is about a scientific case for the biblical account of human origins, and a book called Creating Life in the Lab, which are attempts to use techniques in synthetic biology to create artificial non-natural life forms. So in some respects, it's a logical extension of those two books.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it's something very different than I've ever done before.
I'll just tell our listeners, it took me about 3 weeks to digest your book. I mean, I was pretty focused, and I learned a great deal about secular ethics, about transhumanism, posthumanism, in its history. So Humans 2.0 and the topic of transhumanism, can you just in a nutshell tell our listeners what transhumanism actually means?
This is an idea that is really a kind of a combination of science and technology, philosophy and theology. It's all kind of rolled into one. But the bottom line is that people that espouse the transhumanist vision see an obligation that we have as human beings to use science and technology to improve upon our biological makeup, to enhance our physical strength or intellectual capabilities or psychological well-being beyond our natural biological limits. The idea behind doing this is noble to some degree because they see this as a way to alleviate pain and suffering. They see the human body as inherently flawed, being the product of an evolutionary history. So they want to use science and technology to correct these flaws, and going one step further to enhance our, again, our capabilities beyond our natural limits. But they also see this as a way to not only end pain and suffering, but to promote human flourishing, and maybe to even attain some type of utopian future. And of course, one of the greatest enemies that we face as human beings is death. And so they see science and technology as the way to extend our life expectancy, maybe even attain some form of immortality. And so, in effect, what you see here is science and technology functioning as the mode or the means for salvation for not only the human species, but for individuals. And so this is where the movement takes on a very strong religious element or a religious flavor.
Certainly you and your co-author, Ken Samples, Fuzz, point out that one of your goals for this book is to explain to Christians, and including those physicians, those in healthcare, that we need to engage with those who are promoting this, because there's a lot in common that we have with transhumanists, including the gospel. Looking at the gospel, transhumanists have some goals that you point out in the book are laudable, that we can have some common ground with them. Talk to us about that.
My concern is that as Christians, we tend, when it comes to things like emerging biotechnologies, to either ignore those advances or to condemn them, but we really don't oftentimes do a good job of effectively engaging these ideas. And the point of the book really is to try to encourage Christians to see transhumanism as ultimately a golden opportunity to present the gospel, because what transhumanists desire is really reflecting a deep need that every human being has. We want to see an end to pain and suffering. We want to see human beings flourish because we realize that the world is not the way that the world's supposed to be. And so transhumanists want to use science and technology to fulfill that ache that's in each of us, and they want a utopian future. They want some form of immortality. They recognize that death somehow isn't natural. They want hope. They want destiny. They want purpose. And this is, of course, what Christianity offers in the gospel. But, you know, as Christians, we believe that the gospel is the true means by which we get salvation, the genuine place where our hope resides. And so the fact that transhumanism is exposing these needs really gives us an opportunity to step in if we are effective in terms of engaging transhumanism with a counter proposal, if you will, the one that's found in the person of Christ. So this is a golden opportunity to share the gospel, and I don't want the church to lose out on this opportunity because our culture is begging for what the gospel offers.
You know, Fuzz, the cover of your book is just so well done. A robotic hand on the front cover. It took me back to my high school years when Empire Strikes Back comes out and Luke Skywalker, you know, has his hand chopped off and we're like all aghast. And then next scene, he's got this robotic hand and is able to be Luke again. Back in those days, it seemed so far-fetched, but your book does a good job of going through cutting-edge technologies that are out there. Just talk to us briefly about some of those technologies that are amazing.
Yeah, well, you know, one area that I find totally fascinating involves computer-brain interface technology, where people have discovered that the electrical activity in our brain can be marshaled to control machines, and we can actually receive electrical input from machines in our brains, and our brains can learn to process that input. So through the use of a computer brain interface, it allows the communication between a brain and a machine. And this is absolutely fascinating because patients can learn through these computer brain interfaces that can either be implanted in the brain, reside on the surface of the brain, or be external through things like EEG caps, can learn with their thoughts to control computer software, computer hardware, robotic prosthetic limbs, exoskeletons, neuroprosthetic types of devices. And so this is astounding breakthroughs that are happening where the preliminary preclinical type studies really indicate that within decades, we're going to probably have revolutionary treatments for people that are locked in, people that are quadriplegics, paraplegics, amputees. You know, this is, it's astounding in terms of these advances that are taking place where, you know, that science fiction yes. depiction that you described with Luke Skywalker is really becoming a reality before our very eyes. And this raises all kinds of very provocative questions about who are we as human beings? What does it mean to be a human person? You know, questions related to who should get access to this technology because it's going to be very expensive. But it's also very hopeful and transformative in terms of what that technology could translate into in terms of really changing people's lives.
Well, your book, you spent a fair amount of time, which was so helpful to me. I've heard a lot about CRISPR technology and about gene editing. And I think for those who get the book, it will be a very great primer on gene editing. And this month, 35 years ago, Fuzz, I had my first medical-related job. I worked in a genetics lab at Indiana University for Dr. Hodes, who was looking at the autosomal dominant inherited Huntington's disease. And I was just a lab rat. I didn't know much at all about DNA or DNA sequencing. But in 1984, we were sequencing DNA and figuring out where the gene was for Huntington's disease. And reading your book and preparing for this interview, I got online. And lo and behold, this year in January, the FDA approved the first trials for a new vector to introduce a cassette of DNA, as they call it, into brain cells to try to halt the progression of Huntington's disease, a neurologic degeneration. So it's taken some time, but some actual applications for treating somatic cells, not germline cells, but somatic cells, which you point out in your book.
Yeah, you know, and this is the thing that's astounding. The advances that are happening with CRISPR gene editing are so rapid that it's impossible to keep up with these advances. I mean, every time I turn around, there are new advances, and I'm just as surprised as you with what's happening, even though I spent quite a bit of time, you know, reading about CRISPR-Cas9 and looking at, you know, the preclinical studies and the early stage clinical studies that have been done. You know, and this is a beautiful example of, you know, where this gene editing technology may take us. You know, the thing about CRISPR technology compared to other types of gene editing technologies is it's very powerful and high precision, but it also is really inexpensive and very easy to use. In fact, if you're into these kind of things, you can go on Amazon and for under $200 buy a CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing kit that can allow you to do some very basic experiments with the gene editing technology on your kitchen counter. That's how easy it is to use. And so it's literally going to be transformative. Now, there's a number of issues still that need to be resolved. One of them is what are called off-target effects. Even though the gene editing is highly precise, there still are instances where the gene editing package will edit the wrong region of the genome. And of course, that's not a good thing.
Yes.
You know, when you're introducing the vector, you can create, you know, inflammatory responses and things like that. So there's still some pretty real technical issues to resolve, but we now really literally have the capability at our fingertips to, you know, to replace defective genes with healthy genes, to turn genes off, to disable genes. This could be very useful in treating things like the HIV virus, for example, disabling the HIV DNA within genomes. We can, do editing where you're not replacing the gene, but just replacing a few nucleotides. So, I mean, the sky's the limit in terms of the biomedical applications.
You do spend a fair amount of time, Fuzz, talking about the ethics of embryonic stem cell research versus somatic cell research. Talk to us a little bit about the ethics of some of the work that's going on in the transhumanism movement. And you have a great primer there in the book, really about secular ethics and how they're really inadequate for this situation.
The complexity of it is these technologies can obviously be used for good, but even in a biomedical context, there's a number of ethical questions surrounding their usage. And those ethical questions become, I think, exacerbated, or those ethical concerns maybe become exacerbated as we move from biomedical treatments to enhancements to then, you know, trying to evolve human beings into a post-human species. And so the ethics is a real issue. And one of the concerns that I've seen expressed by secular bioethicists is we don't have the categories to actually properly deliberate on these emerging technologies. These technologies are emerging so rapidly and are creating brand new categories, you know, that really, I think, confound a secular approach to bioethics. And so in the book, Ken Samples and I spend some time just highlighting why secular ethics is really ineffective at deliberating on how these technologies should be used. But instead of looking to a new system of ethics, we actually think an ancient system of ethics could be very useful, and that's an ethics built around the Christian worldview and the idea of the image of God. Because of the image of God, we want to see human beings flourish. We want to minimize pain and suffering, but we also want to make sure that humans are not exploited, that we want to make sure that people that are marginalized actually have access to this technology, that there's a just distribution of these medical advances. And if they're used for enhancements, that everybody has equal access to those enhancements. And so the Christian worldview, because of the image of God concept, I think uniquely puts in place a framework that balances those two competing ideas. But then on top of that, the Christian worldview also has a very strong orientation towards scientific advance and promoting technology development. And so I think the Christian worldview has a lot to offer when it comes to these issues. But the issues are complex, and we tried in the book to shy away from saying these are the solutions to these ethical problems, mm-hmm. but rather give people the tools to realize how the Christian worldview can help us deliberate on these. You know, just as an example for the complexity, you know, there are people that are concerned, like when it comes to computer-brain interfaces, is this going to rob people of their dignity? Is this going to rob people of their humanity? Because as we begin to meld people with machines, where does that line end? You know, where does the human end and the machine begin? But on the other hand, for somebody who is locked in or somebody who is a quadriplegic, this technology could actually give them back their humanity. Mm-hmm. And so this is the complexity of the issue. Is it okay, you know, the ethics? Is it okay to enhance human beings and let them use exoskeletons to enhance their physical strength if there's a legitimate reason to do that? You know, or is this maybe a line we shouldn't cross? So the issues are complex, but I think the Christian worldview has a lot to offer in the dialogue on how this technology should be used in a way that isn't condemning it, that isn't ignoring it, but is actually trying to foster the technology development in the best possible way so that humans genuinely flourish and nobody is marginalized or exploited in the process.
You wrote a great chapter entitled The Problem with Progress, and you point out that transhumanists often are not really honest with us and with themselves about the history of technology. And while it brings great benefits, it also brings with it its own set of problems that tend to beget more technology needed to fix those problems, and it's a vicious cycle.
You know, one of the things that undergirds the transhumanist movement is this idea of the myth of progress. And it's kind of this narrative that as we develop new technologies, as we make scientific advances, those breakthroughs are going to inevitably lead to human progress, to improving the human condition. That's the view that ultimately undergirds transhumanism. But when you look at the history of technology, when you look at the philosophy of technology, scholars that work in these areas pretty much to a person agree that we have a very complex relationship with technology. It's an uneasy relationship because technology really defines in many respects who we are as human beings. Mm-hmm. We are techno-sapiens in many respects. Technology has allowed us to conquer every environment on the planet in such a way that we can live and flourish in these incredibly diverse environments as a human species. But yet, on the other hand, while technology does improve the quality of our lives, it's a double-edged sword. Every time there's an advance in technology that is designed to mitigate pain and suffering or to free us from the shackles of labor, we wind up becoming enslaved to that technology many times, or that technology creates a whole host of other problems that never existed before. And many times those problems are actually worse. And so what do? We try to develop new technology to solve those problems, and we wind up really exacerbating the problem. And of course, there's always unintended consequences that we can never foresee. And then when you throw in the sinful nature of human beings, you know, that technology can also be misused for horrific evil. And so the more powerful the technology, the more transformative the technology, the more concern there is about the misuse of the technology or the unanticipated consequences. And so the fact of the matter is, to try to place your hope and your trust in technology really ultimately is a false gospel. Mm-hmm. You're going to be disappointed. And so the transhumanism vision, as much as I think I can affirm what people are really desiring, I think the use of technology is not going to get us there. In fact, it may actually do the opposite. It may wind up creating such an existential crisis for humanity that it may drive us to our own extinction.
Is there any kind of regulation on this technology at this point in time, Fuzz?
Not really. I mean, what I typically am seeing is the scientific community trying to police itself and trying to put in place voluntary regulations that they are strongly encouraging people to, you know, adhere to. There are some, obviously, regulations about what you can do experimentally with a human embryo. You know, beyond 14 days, you can't experiment with a human embryo. And so there are some, you know, minimal regulations, but the technology is progressing so rapidly that, you know, regulatory agencies can't keep up with the advances in such a way to put in place regulations. And in fact, there's this DIY biology movement that's emerging where there are people who argue that these kind of technologies should not be limited to the academic and professional elites, but that every person should have the right to this technology. And there's a scientist by the name of Josiah Gaynor who is advocating this biology DIY movement. And he actually has injected himself in a public forum at a public, you know, technology conference with a CRISPR gene editing package that disables the gene for myostatin, which is a gene that controls and regulates muscle development. Mm-hmm. And people have shown that in dogs and in racehorses, disabling that gene produces these animals that are almost grotesque in terms of their musculature. They look like an Arnold Schwarzenegger version of a dog or of a racehorse. And so this is a way to prove, again, how easy it is to use this, he injected himself with that gene editing kit with the idea of disabling his myostatin genes. Now, this was a publicity stunt, but what it's saying is that it doesn't take much for this kind of technology to wind up in a private sector where people can sidestep regulations if they do exist, and you're going to probably create an entire underground industry of people seeking CRISPR-Cas9 treatments to improve their intellectual capabilities, their physical strength, to try to extend their life expectancy, you know, particularly people that have the financial means to do that. So, you know, this is going to create a very interesting future when you may actually have legitimate medical practitioners trying to use this technology responsibly, and because of the inexpensive nature and the ease of use of the technology, have a whole shadow medical industry that is doing things that are probably ill-advised with the technology. And probably physicians are going to wind up having to step in at some point in the future to try to correct the mess that this DIY biology movement is going to create.
I just want to wrap up by asking what you and your co-author Ken Samples, what do you ultimately hope to impart to those who read your book, Humans 2.0?
The hope is really to put this on people's radar screens, particularly Christians, so that they understand that transhumanism is not this fringe idea, but it really is becoming a mainstream idea in the academy and is filtering down very quickly into to the people on the street. And that we want Christians to understand the science behind transhumanism and to be cognizant of the ethical issues and begin to learn and know how to engage the ethical issues, but more importantly, how to see this as really an opportunity to build a bridge to the gospel. So the hope is that we respond positively and effectively to the transhumanist movement in a way that we are really engaging our culture, not withdrawing or not condemning.
Fuzz, I want to thank you for joining us today, and I hope that many of our listeners will go out and get this book with this incredible robotic hand on the front cover. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, I don't know about you, but before reading Humans 2.0, I must admit I had only a very superficial understanding of many of the terms used in this book and the concepts that we just talked about. I hope this interview has stimulated your thinking as much as it did mine. This past weekend, my wife and I had the joyous experience of being present for our middle daughter Kayla's public baptism at age 20. She had previously been baptized in the Indian Ocean as a child, but really felt led to be baptized as an adult as she prepares actually to get married this coming May. I was thinking about how baptism is so symbolic, representing a transformation, a new person. The scripture that I'm guessing many of you memorized like I did in high school from 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 17, where Paul states that if anyone is in Christ, he or she is a new creation. The old has passed away and the new has come. So I was thinking maybe we could look at this as a transnumanism, if you will, transnumanism. I don't think it's entirely too far-fetched to think about the fact that there really will be humans 2.0, and Jesus showed us the prototype of his new body for 40 days after his resurrection. God's word tells us that, quote, we will be like him, that is Jesus, for we shall see him as he is. What a wonderful hope that you and I have to share with our patients and their families and our coworkers who are struggling with the disease and addictions and faults of humans 1.0. I want to encourage you to get Dr. Rana's book, Humans 2.0, which you can find on Amazon. And if you live in the central Indiana area, you can actually meet and hear Dr. Fuzz Rana at the Spring CMDA Indianapolis event. That's taking place Tuesday, March 10th. That will be at 7 p.m. at the College Park Church Chapel on West 96th Street. If you'd like to find out more details or information, you can contact the CMDA Midwest Regional Director, Alan Harmer. His phone number, 317-257-5885. That's 317-257-5885. Or you can email Alan at CMDAMW, which stands for Midwest, at CMDA.org. CMDAMW at CMDA.org. We do carry a couple of other books at CMDA that also discuss human enhancement technologies. One of those is by Dr. John Kellner of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity at Trinity University in Chicago. The book is entitled Why the Church Needs Bioethics. This book has three true-to-life case studies with leading Christian voices that bring biblical and theological perspectives to bear on these incredible medical technologies that are available today. And then longtime friend of CMDA, one of our former trustees and a bioethicist, Dr. Bob Orr, has written a book called Medical Ethics and the Faith Factor. It was written for clergy and healthcare professionals in guiding us to answer the question, should we? Should we use a feeding tube for mom? How should we deal with our baby about to be born with life-threatening anomalies? You can get both of these books from our bookstore, and you can go online to cmda.org/shop, S-H-O-P, or you can call 888-230-2637, and one of my staff will be happy to get one or both of these books in the mail to you. If you're interested in bioethics, and more importantly, in protecting your right of conscience, then please consider joining me in Dallas, Texas at the Right of Conscience and Cultural Change in Medicine Conference, February 29th, a Saturday. There will be six great speakers who will address medical, legal, and theological concerns that we're facing in medicine today. If you'd like to find out more, go to our website, cmda.org/ROC event. That stands for Right of Conscience. ROC event, and there will be up to 4 hours of CME credit available during that summit on February 29th. Well, that's it for this week's CMDA Matters podcast. This is a podcast specifically for healthcare professionals because what matters to you as a follower of Christ in healthcare matters to CMDA. God bless you today.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.